Hello, and welcome to Translating the Medicaid Expansion into Increased Coverage, the Role of Application Assistance. Your audio is available today by computer speaker or by teleconference. If you have trouble with the computer audio, please click the picture of the telephone below your name in the participant panel for teleconference information. Alternately, you can send a question through the Q&A panel, and we'll be happy to provide teleconference information to you. All of our phone lines will be on mute throughout the presentation. To ask a question, please use the Q&A panel, which is located at the lower right-hand side of your screen. If you go to full screen mode, you can access that panel through the pop-out menu at the top center of your screen. I would now like to hand over to Samantha Artigas of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Samantha?
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today for our Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured webinar, Translating the Medicaid Expansion into Increased Coverage, the Role of Application Assistance. Again, my name is Samantha Artigas with the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and I'd like to welcome you to what is the first webinar in our new Getting Into Gear for 2014 series of webinars and briefs that will examine key implementation issues as we move into the final stretch of preparations for the Affordable Care Act coverage expansions. Today, we look forward to having a great discussion about the important role application assistance will play in helping to translate the ACA's Medicaid and other coverage expansions into increased coverage. We have a wonderful panel that we will be hearing from today, who I will introduce shortly. But first, I want to extend some thanks to my colleague Jessica Stevens with the Kaiser Commission, who really played an instrumental role in bringing this event together, and then go over a few additional housekeeping items. First, slides and a recording of this webinar will be made available after the event through our website at kfs.org. Our goal is to leave room for Q&A following the presentations. As was mentioned, you can submit questions through the Q&A panel of the webinar, and we will be accepting questions throughout the course of the webinar, so feel free to submit them as we move forward through the presentations. I do warn that we have a lot of folks listening in today, so we're unlikely to get through all the questions, but we'll do our best to get through as many as possible. Lastly, if you have any technical questions, you can seek assistance through that same Q&A panel, and there will be someone available to assist you. Now, to get started, looking forward to 2014, the ACA's Medicaid and exchange coverage expansions really provide a historic opportunity to increase coverage among millions of individuals. 2014 will also usher in new streamlined enrollment processes that are intended to provide a welcoming and consumer-friendly enrollment experience for individuals and eliminate many of the historic procedural barriers to Medicaid enrollment. However, even with new streamlined processes in place, many individuals are going to both want and need direct one-on-one application assistance, and the ACA establishes an array of programs to provide this assistance. As we plan for 2014, it is useful to draw on the existing experience we already have from Medicaid and CHIP. There are many key lessons from previous Medicaid and CHIP experience that can help inform our future efforts. Moreover, there is an existing network of assistance for Medicaid and CHIP enrollment that it will be important to build upon as we look to building new assistance efforts to incorporate together. For example, in our most recent January 2013 50-state survey of Medicaid eligibility and enrollment policies, we found that nearly half of states are already providing funding for community-based application assisters for Medicaid and CHIP today, and over two-thirds have outstationed state eligibility workers in place in places like hospitals, clinics, public health offices, and schools. The main goals of today are to discuss some of these key lessons learned from past Medicaid and CHIP experience, to examine the importance of providing assistance under the ACA, and to begin to explore where states are in their planning efforts to provide this assistance. And I'm so excited about the fabulous panel of experts we have available today to provide this information. Our first two presentations will really focus on previous Medicaid and CHIP experience. First, we will hear from Dr. Carol Stippelman, a pediatrician with the University of Utah, who will tell us about her experience with a very successful enrollment assistance initiative among community health centers in Utah that she initiated by training AmeriCorps workers placed within her clinic to provide enrollment assistance. This initiative is also profiled in a new Kaiser brief that was released today and is now available on our website at kff.org. Next, we will hear from Donna Cohen-Ross, a senior policy advisor with the Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services at CMS, who will identify some broad lessons from Medicaid and CHIP that can help inform our ACA coverage efforts looking forward. Then, our last two presenters will focus on planning efforts looking ahead. Jennifer Sullivan, director of the Best Practices Institute with Enroll America, is going to share their exciting new research to give us insight into what consumers say about their interests and preferences for assistance. And then Jennifer Edwards, managing principal with Health Management Associates, will finish with some information about state's current planning efforts to provide assessments. Lastly, Jennifer Tolbert, our Director of State Health Reform here at Kaiser, who directs our work tracking exchange development activities, will also be joining us to help answer questions during our Q&A period. So now I'd like to turn things over to Dr. Stippelman to get started, and I'll again remind folks to submit questions through the Q&A function as we go. Dr. Stippelman, please get us started.
All right. Thank you for that introduction, Samantha, and for the invitation to speak. It's truly an honor to be part of this panel. This project began in 2008 when I was the only pediatrician for four family medicine clinics in Salt Lake that formed a federally qualified health center system. And as the only pediatrician, my panel contained a high proportion of medically complex children. And when those kids lose their coverage, it's difficult to care for them. We did have outstation eligibility workers from state Medicaid housed in the clinic, but their caseload is really too large to provide individual case management. So I found myself in between patients running the families over to the outstation eligibility workers so I could try to act as the family's enrollment advocate. I knew that someone who could dedicate all their time and passion to this effort would be doing a better job than I was doing. So I looked around the clinic and I saw a resource. We had AmeriCorps workers, part of the AmeriCorps and the Medically Underserved in Utah program, who were serving in the clinic. These are typically pre-college volunteers who receive a stipend and a scholarship for their service. So with a grant from the American Academy of Pediatrics Community Access to Child Health program, we performed a pilot study to see if we could train the AmeriCorps workers to improve enrollment by providing one-on-one case management. We were lucky enough to have another clinic with a similar population that could serve as a control clinic. At the intervention clinic, we started with consent access proxy, filling out the application, documentation, interviews, all the way to case closure. At the non-intervention clinic, the AmeriCorps worker identified eligible but uninsured children a check-in, and parents were given an application, an explanation how to fill it out and where to drop it off, but there was no other intervention offered. And we had about 100 children in each group. Next slide. Next slide, please. Yes. You can see that in the intervention clinic, 74% of the case managed cases were enrolled after 3 months, compared with 26% of the non-intervention cases. On the right side of the slide, you can see that we also looked at reasons for non-enrollment. And amongst the non-intervention cases, 76% of the denials were due to non-submission of the application. While every one of the intervention cases had an application submitted, actually the largest reason for denial in the intervention group was due to failure to submit all the documentation. And Utah actually requires quite a bit of documentation, including school report cards and vaccination records. Next slide, please. We also looked at utilization of preventive care in the 6 months following eligibility determination, comparing enrolled children to non-enrolled. This has been looked at before. There are very large studies showing reduced utilization of preventive care with loss of coverage, but this study was purely FQHC children who could access a well visit for a sliding scale fee that was equivalent to a reasonable copay with private insurance at that time. So I really didn't know if parents would continue to forfeit preventive care for their uninsured children even in the light of availability of a sliding scale fee. And they did indeed do that, unfortunately. We stratified by age because of the different recommended preventive care visits per age group, and we found a significant difference in each stratum. And I can tell you as a pediatrician, it concerned me the most that infants who were uninsured were not brought in for preventive care visits in that very important first year of development. Next slide, please. So then with Utah's Primary Care Association, the Association for Utah Community Health, we received a Cycle 1 CHIPPER grant, and with that we were able to spread the model to 8 SQHC clinics, 5 urban, 1 homeless, and 2 rural. And the enrollment specialists at each clinic came from the community the clinic was serving. They were really integrated into clinic flow, and they became trusted members of the clinic staff. And magic really began to happen. Doctors invited the enrollment specialist into the exam room to introduce the enrollment specialist to the family within the context of that trusted patient-doctor relationship. And I can tell you, by the end of the project, the more talented enrollment specialists had patients lining up outside their offices, through the lobby, and out the clinic door. And we had to teach these sweet, passionate young people to set limits so they could go home at night. Next slide. All but one of the clinics continued a form of the project post-funding. It was really found that the enrollment specialists generated sufficient revenue to cover the cost of their employment. So I can say, I feel confident saying that AmeriCorps workers are a cost-effective way to provide enrollment assistance, but with one caveat, these are young workers, they require training, retraining, and mentoring, and their service is for 1 to 2 years, so you need to be ready to train them repeatedly. Next slide. Our project has continued to grow. In terms of AmeriCorps workers, we now have 15 of them at 9 sites, and many other clinics are running the program with non-AmeriCorps staff, so they have more consistency. We have formed a coalition that includes the PCA, Association for Utah Community Health, United Way 211, United Way Salt Lake, and Utah Health Policy Project. And the coalition is now moving into school districts, Head Start, and other non-clinical community-based organizations. The database that we began developing during the pilot study, we continue to improve it during the CHIPPER grant, has received funding, and we're currently turning it into a cloud-based program that's customizable. And it helps the enrollment assistant through the whole application process, including reminders for submission and renewal dates, and very important to me, reminders for primary care visits, not just well visits for children, but also visits for chronic disease such as diabetes, asthma, and obesity. And of course, it tracks outcome measures. We've also created an 8-module training curriculum so that other community-based organizations can adapt the program to their needs. And we plan to make completion of all 8 modules to grant certification as a prerequisite for using the cloud-based database. So that's a whirlwind tour of what we've done so far. And I'd also like to say that after providing enrollment assistance during a period of significant enhancement of online application services in Utah, I believe more than ever that no matter how good your software is, you will always need to provide one-on-one enrollment assistance to serve underserved populations. That's it. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Carol. It is so wonderful to hear about the great success you've had out there in Utah. And I would again encourage folks to go to our website if they're interested in learning more about this initiative to view the case study that we released today profiling it. And now we're going to turn it over again to Donna Cohen-Ross, who's going to share some key lessons learned from Medicaid and CHIP as we think towards 2014. And just so folks know, there will not be slides advancing through this portion, so there's not something wrong with your system.
Thank you so much, Samantha, and thank you for that caveat that if people don't see slides advancing, there's nothing the matter. You'll just have my voice. I'm very happy to be with you this afternoon to talk about this topic of critical importance, the value of application assistance in assuring that eligible families and individuals gain access to the health coverage that best meets their needs. As we're all very much aware, we're on the verge of a new world when it comes to how people find out about health insurance and how they enroll in coverage. But I'm here today to take you back a step. We need to know where we've come from in order to figure out where we're going. I think there's an old saying goes that way or something like that. And in many ways, our longstanding experience with Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program has really helped to pave the way for what we're about to experience going forward. In addition to the efforts undertaken by Medicaid and CHIP programs, state programs to vastly simplify their program operations, particularly with respect to children's enrollment, their support of community-based application assistance has also taught us a great deal and has helped to guide us moving forward. And as Dr. Stippelman's presentation makes clear, we also benefit enormously from the work of our CHIPRA outreach grantees. We're very proud of the kinds of accomplishments she shared with you, and I'll be sharing some additional lessons from their efforts as well, and tell you where we are with that particular program. What we know about application assistance comes both from research and also from experience. So first I want to give you some highlights from some of the research that we've undertaken, knowing that in a few minutes you're going to hear about some more recent research that goes, I think, a little bit more under the surface. But I want to kind of give you that background. About 2 years ago, we published the findings of a national Medicaid and CHIP beneficiary satisfaction survey, which was a nationwide survey of nearly 2,000 parents of children who are eligible for Medicaid or CHIP. About a third of them had children enrolled in the programs, another third had children in employer-sponsored coverage, and the remainder had children who are uninsured. Parents told us a lot about the positive ways they viewed the programs, and I do recommend the full study to you. You can find it on our website, www.insurekidsnow.gov. They also shared a lot about how they viewed the enrollment process, and their responses steered us in helpful directions with respect to how to best provide information and assistance. And those are the findings that I want to give you. I want to talk about some of the highlights of those findings in the next couple of minutes, again, because I think they put us in the right path to what we need to be doing now and going forward. One of the top barriers to enrolling in Medicaid and CHIP, the parents told us, is that there is a perception that the enrollment process is very difficult, maybe too difficult to accomplish on their own. Of those currently without children in Medicaid and CHIP, about half of them think that enrolling their child in Medicaid and CHIP would be somewhat or very hard. And again, this is a perception. As I said a moment ago, states have come a very long way in making their enrollment processes easier. So sometimes it may be past experiences that have kind of colored the views of families with respect to their concerns about going forward, but also, and I think that Dr. Stippelman mentioned this at the very end, and you'll hear, I think perhaps all of us say it, as easy as we make the process, there will be always be people who need help, and that one-to-one assistance is crucial. There also was uncertainty about where to apply or where to get information about Medicaid and CHIP. That was also a barrier for some, and we'll talk about that outreach piece in just a moment. The following finding is one that I know Jenny Sullivan's going to talk more about, but this was the first time that we actually directly asked this question in a survey. But we found in this survey many parents said that they would be more likely to apply for Medicaid and CHIP if they could fill out an application online. They also talked about their willingness to apply by mail or by telephone. 62% of parents said they'd be much more or somewhat more likely to apply if it meant they could fill out their application online. So this was kind of at that time a new finding for us because people were just getting a lot more comfortable and savvy about working with online applications. But I feel very safe in saying that it paved the way for where we were about to go. These preferences in terms of mode of application did vary by education, income, and the language spoken, with nearly three-quarters of college graduates, about 72%, saying they'd be more likely to enroll if it meant applying online, with only 14% saying they'd be more likely to enroll if it meant going to a government office. In contrast, 62% of Spanish-speaking parents said they would be more likely to enroll if it meant applying at a government office. And that was something that at first was a surprise to many people, but I think some of the things we learned later helped explain that. When presented with a list of nine potential messengers, our thought was the messenger is probably as important as the message. Not surprisingly, after hearing Dr. Sippelman's presentation, doctors topped the list in terms of people who were trusted by parents for information and also help. And so that was a really important thing to learn for us. Also included in the high trust category were nurses, social workers, and also other parents who had used the Medicaid and CHIP program. Schools were another source of information and help for parents, but not as high as healthcare providers. And of course, we do a lot of work in school-based settings, so that gave us something to think about. So those are the highlights in this area of research. As I mentioned, a lot of what we know is also from our experience, and some of the things I'm going to share with you now are also items that you can find on our website on insurekidsnow.gov in various places. We have an outreach video library that focuses on some of these activities. We also have CHIPRA annual reports that highlight some of these things. So I'm just going to give you kind of the nuggets of things that I think will be helpful to you. If you want to read more about them or view more about them, they're available to you. One of the first things that I would say without any hesitation at all, that outreach without a connection to application assistance is just half a loaf. We really can't get the job done unless we can put those pieces together. Some groups, whether they are outreach partners throughout the country, whether there are CHIPRA grantees, they have done a great job of using their outreach activities to drive people to application assistance. And one group that comes to mind is one that we actually did a video to highlight. It's Healthcare for All in Massachusetts. With the phone-a-thon that they conducted, they used a lot of their outreach efforts to work with community organizations, with the local media, to let people know that a phone-a-thon was going to be happening on a particular day, getting a lot of enthusiasm ginned up in the community, and also information about how to access the phone-a-thon, which was an opportunity to apply for coverage for your child over the telephone. The day of the phone-a-thon was an extremely busy and exciting day, but the result is really what was so exciting. The Healthcare for All helpline typically enrolls 150 to 200 children over the course of about a three-month period. The day of the phone-a-thon, 300 children were enrolled in one day. So there was a lot of effort and a lot of resources going into it, but the result was something that was really quite remarkable. Simplification is another piece that we talk about so much. Simplification being good for consumers, good for states in administering their program, and I would also say that it's good for application assistance. When we have a simple process, assisters are more likely to be able to feel very confident in helping people get through the process. When they feel confident, they engender that feeling among the people that they're helping, and it goes faster and more easily, and the result is a good result. Families need to feel they're in good hands, and I think that's part of that finding that I mentioned about some people actually wanting to go to the Medicaid office for help. They want to go where they think people know the most and can help them the most. So families need to feel they're in good hands. And again, I think Dr. Stippelman's experience shows that as well. The activity that I would bring to your attention is also another one that we do have a video on our website about, and it is the Miami-Dade County Public Schools have a partnership with University of Miami Medical School, where they do have a mobile clinic that comes to schools to provide some healthcare services to children, and at the same time that parents are talking with the medical students and providers who come on that that mobile clinic, they're also able to get their children enrolled in coverage. So again, connecting those pieces, you know, children being and parents being available at school, but also wanting healthcare providers, that trusted source, is very important. And I think also another piece that's very important is that it's those medical students that are getting, I think, a very important part of their education by being part of that enrollment process. Another lesson that I think is very high on the list is that it is most effective to provide application assistance at critical times when families are thinking about the health of their children, when they're seeking care, when they're seeking other services as well. The state of Oklahoma has done tremendous work in helping families get enrolled online. There's a lot of material about that, and Kaiser Commission has published some information about that and had Oklahoma as a guest at a recent event. But I also wanted to point out that they have pioneered an online enrollment opportunity for hospitals, so that when new babies are born, they can be enrolled in Medicaid before they even leave the hospital. And this online enrollment opportunity has meant that they have really ramped up the percentage of babies that go home and are enrolled in Medicaid and connected to a provider within 5 days. It's somewhere upwards of 85%. 80 or 85% of those children. And so that is an important piece as well. In Colorado, our CHIPRA grantee there has connects the school-based health clinics with application assistants who are available in the school. So when the clinic is identifying children who are in need of health coverage and may be eligible, those application assistants are available on site to assist with application, completing the application. I think a lot of these examples also bring us to another important lesson, and that is enrollment requires privacy and attention. It's something that's very personal to people, it's very important to them, and I think that's why we have found that sometimes big events like health fairs, those kind of big public events, are good places to give people information, but not necessarily the best places to sit down and actually do an application. So those outreach partners who have used those big events to help people make appointments and direct them to community-based application assistance have found that is a good way to connect those two activities. And finally, I would just say that it's important to embed application assistance into the routine of community-based organizations, clinics, et cetera. Again, we heard about that in Utah. Some of the school-based activities help institutionalize application assistance, but also 211, for example, that quick number that people can call. United Way organizations run 211 in a lot of communities. They're places people can go when they have questions about all kinds of help that they might need or public benefits. Having the application assistance available at 211 has shown to be a really important piece, and it's a way of embedding that activity into the routine that an organization is already that's already in place. And I would just say again, just how pleased and proud we are of the activities that are going on under the CHIPRA Outreach and Enrollment Grants. We're looking forward to our Cycle 3 grants, our Connecting Kids to Coverage grants that are under review. We're just beginning the review process, and we anticipate that we'll be making some awards in June, and we're really eager to see where some of those grant projects will take us. I'm going to stop there and turn it back to Samantha. Thank you so much.
Great, Donna. Thanks so much. I think there are a lot of great lessons there that we should all be keeping in mind as we look forward to 2014 and the Medicaid and exchange coverage expansions. Next, we're going to turn it over to Jennifer Sullivan from Enroll America, who's going to give us some insight into what the consumers who are targeted by those expansions have to say about their preferences and interest in having application assistance available.
Great. Thanks, Samantha, and thanks so much, Donna, for laying that excellent foundation for the new findings that I'm about to share. Enroll America took it upon ourselves to do some public education research last fall, and so the findings I'm about to share come from that. We worked with a couple of firms to do both a survey as well as focus groups. We surveyed 1,800 folks in the survey, and then the focus groups were in 10 cities. Both were conducted in English as well as Spanish when that was the preference. And the number one finding from that, which is not on the slide you're looking at now, but the number one finding for us was that so many of the folks who are going to be newly eligible for coverage don't know about it. But the good news is, when we got deeper and were able to talk with folks about that, when we told them the changes that were coming and the new forms of coverage that were going to be available, almost universally they were interested in learning more. But as the slide does show, 3/4 of them expect that they're going to need help to connect to these new options. Now, that makes sense because we talked with them about their past experiences trying to obtain affordable coverage. It was overwhelmingly a negative experience. The process was confusing. It was overwhelming. It left them feeling worried, feeling helpless, and most of them, frankly, weren't able to connect to coverage. Now, this is where help comes in. In order to get them from that negative place to a more positive place where they're actually motivated to go out and seek coverage again, go through the process and connect to coverage. In many cases, when we're talking about the exchange population, they're obviously going to be asked to purchase coverage. We need to get them feeling more secure, more confident, and more reassured. And that's where help comes in and is absolutely crucial to turning those emotions around. Next slide. So as we think about the new process, obviously there will be an online application. There will be, the division is for its Sorry, next slide. I'll wait, let the slides catch up. There we go. We wanted to look a little deeper about how connected the uninsured population was. And as you can see in this slide, and I'll say that the information here that's segmented by different groups of the uninsured, this information is not yet available online, but it's coming soon on our website. The entire sort of overview research results are already available on our website, enrollamerica.org. But when we looked at how connected these folks were to the internet, I know it's often tempting to think this is not a population that's using the internet. There are barriers that this is not a good way to reach folks. Well, certainly, particularly for the lower income folks, they're not accessing the internet or having smartphones or maybe using text messages as much as average Americans, but they are pretty connected. But what we took away from that is not necessarily that this is the best place for them to go online and enroll in coverage on their own, but rather this is a good opportunity to get messages out, to use peer-to-peer messaging so that folks can really share information with one another as they're starting to experience this new system, and for them to go online at their own leisure, explore these new websites for coverage, and start to build credibility and understand that this is a trustworthy system that they want to take part in. But I'm going to go to the next slide. When we talk about actually taking that step and enrolling in coverage, there are significant barriers to doing this online on your own. Now, the vision is that somebody might be able to do that, and that's great if that's how they want to do it. But our findings really show that at least 1/3 of folks reported feeling very uncomfortable using a website to find a plan. And furthermore, about 1/2 of them said getting health insurance is just too important to do online. This is not like buying a plane ticket or buying a new pair of shoes. And actually, a lot of folks have gone online to purchase other products in the past. But insurance is just inherently different. And in order to get to a place where they're actually feeling confident, like they understand the purchase, they're going to need help. Next slide. So we tried to dig a bit deeper and look at what kind of help they want to get. And before I go through these findings, I want everybody to sort of keep in mind that people were responding to the survey and answering questions in focus groups based on their current understanding of how the system works and what's available to them. They didn't necessarily know about all the changes that are coming or all of the new systems that are going to be in place. So just keep that in mind. And then I'll say, for all of the categories on this slide except for that where box, which unfortunately I don't have information on the uninsured, these are data for the uninsured. So the where box is our entire population that we surveyed, which included both insured and uninsured folks. So when it comes to what kind of help people want to get, what do they want to get help doing, the top two things were definitely getting help figuring out what kind of financial assistance people qualify for, and then figuring out what's the best plan for me. And this, again, is true in Medicaid as well as the exchange, but certainly there are lots of new questions about what's going to be available and understanding how insurance works that may be more true for folks that are purchasing a plan through the exchange than it might be for folks in the Medicaid and CHIP world. People also wanted help knowing where to go for help, learning how to fill out the application and how to use a website, but those weren't as common responses as that eligibility and picking the best plan for me were. How do people want to get help? Well, I think the theme today is clearly that people want help in person. They want to be able to sit shoulder to shoulder with a real live person who understands the rules and can walk them through the process. Now, telephone, email, online chat, some people are going to want those things. So we definitely don't want to only provide help in person. We need to make sure that the phone and electronic assistance that's available is also robust in providing people good answers. And certain segments of the uninsured, particularly those young adults that comprise such a large portion of the uninsured, may be more drawn to those sort of virtual options. But in-person assistance is overwhelmingly the preference for most. When it comes to who people want help from, as you can see on the slide, people want help from a state employee whose job it is to help. But I would actually encourage you to focus on the whose job it is to help part of that statement. It's not necessarily that every state needs to be doubling its workforce to make sure that everybody has the assistance they need. It's that we need trained folks who understand how to provide help or how to bridge connections when they don't know the right answers to get people through the process. When we look at some of the other popular places to get help, obviously family members are important, doctors and nurses, Medicaid offices, health insurance companies. And I think with the exclusion of family members, what's important about the other sources of help is that all of these entities are trusted sources of other kinds of information besides just enrolling in coverage. You're going to your provider to get medical information, so you're trusting them about that. You are enrolling in a health insurance plan, and so you're trusting the health insurance company to know how that plan is going to work, what's covered and what isn't. Family members, I think, are very important and come in because that's the conduit. And actually, across the board, across all of the different segments, we found that people want help from a family member. They want help from their mom in most cases. And in other cases, people want help from their spouse or their partner. That's going to be important because even if mom or the spouse or partner doesn't have all the answers about how health insurance works, they're going to get asked and they're going to need to be referring people to the right places. That's also true for the other kinds of assisters who may consider providing assistance in a formal capacity, but if they're not doing that, need to figure out how they're going to answer those questions because they're certainly going to be asked and figure out what partnerships they need to forge to make sure that assistance is available for the clients that they're serving. And then finally, the last item here, where do people want to get help? This is pretty similar to who they want to get help from. The bottom line is they want help from somebody who can explain the rules and tell them what's going on. The agent and broker's office did actually come out first in terms of where people wanted to get help. I think that's indicative of, again, people's desire to get help from somebody who can really walk them through all of those nitty-gritty details that they don't think they understand very well. Okay, next slide. I just wanted to wrap it up with sort of some key components for all assistance that we found from our survey findings. Obviously, the most important thing really is that whomever is providing assistance needs to be knowledgeable. People want to know what is and isn't covered, and they want to have good realistic expectations of what their out-of-pocket costs are going to be. They don't want any surprises. They don't want anything hidden in that fine print. They also want somebody who can give them a sense of security, confidence, and reassurance that they're filling out all the paperwork correctly, completely, they're doing it right the first time, and that they know what to expect as the process rolls forward. They know that this process is going to be new, and they want somebody who can guide them through and set expectations. So, as I said before, all of this, including much more detailed segmented reports on specifically the uninsured, Latinos, African Americans, women, as well as young adults, will be available on our website very soon. We'll be happy to share those with you all then. And I'm happy to continue to work with you all to make sure that robust assistance is available in every state.
Great. Thank you, Jenny. I think it's clear from those findings really what a key part of the process assistance is going to be for helping people feel comfortable about enrolling and translating the increased eligibility into new coverage. And so now we're going to turn to Jennifer Edwards with Health Management Associates, who's going to talk to us about
where states are in some of their initial planning efforts for thinking about what assistance is going to look like in 2014.
Thanks, Samantha. My talk will focus on the decisions that states are making and will be making about providing application assistance with enrollment scheduled to begin October 1st. It's based on current information, but new information is expected soon that will tell us more about the roles of various types of assistance. States have extensive experience. Oh, sorry, can you go back to the first slide for now? States have extensive experience enrolling low-income people in coverage, but face some new challenges to enrolling a large number of new eligibles. First, to be clear, assisters are people who would be trained to assist individuals and small businesses in getting health insurance through the exchanges, including Medicaid, CHIP, and qualified health plans. In states that are running their own exchanges, states will oversee the outreach and enrollment functions, including hiring and supervising assisters. States that are engaged in state-federal partnerships will run the assistance program if they are engaged in consumer assistance under their agreement with the federal government. In states with federal exchanges, federal rules will govern the action of navigators who will work under contract with the federal government. And we expect to see some new information about this shortly, as I mentioned. Okay, next slide, please. So how are states proceeding so far? We've been tracking state activity over the past several months, and what we have found is that about a dozen states have now released or are about to release their RFP to contract with navigators, in-person assisters, and/or certified application counselors. All states with state-run or partnership exchanges are expected to begin doing so this summer in order to be ready for October 1st. States with federally facilitated exchanges may still choose to build local capacity to assist with enrollment. We also see that a few states are considering insurance broker protection legislation, which could create some conflict with federal navigator regulations. Next slide. This slide identifies a long list of issues that states are grappling with. These are decisions that are being made in complex environments filled with politics, taking into account differences in viewpoint, and competing demands on the attention of a small group of state leaders. As new states begin to consider how to structure their application assistance, these are the kinds of questions that they will need to deal with. For example, the number of assisters needed. This may depend on the number of uninsured in the state and the breadth of experience that they have with insurance in the past and how long it might take to help them. States will be deciding about the scope of duties and the coordination of these duties among the different assistance types. Given that some people will need different kinds of assistance, it's still important that the message be consistent across all consumers. Many states are grappling with issues about recruitment and roles of existing enrollment assistance entities, such as community-based organizations and insurance brokers. Costs are always a concern, and the funding of startup costs for new assisters is particularly salient right now. How to get the funding out that would help start assisters' roles and then provide financial incentives once the assisters are in place so that they reach out to all potentially eligible people. Another issue that states are discussing is how to coordinate between the state and the federal consumer assistance roles, particularly related to the marketing, the toll-free numbers, and messages. States are also considering how to coordinate for consumers across the income spectrum, knowing that some people may be eligible for one plan one day and a different plan the next day, depending on how their incomes change. The concern about churning and how people will re-enroll is also on the table. In many of the RFAs, there's been particular attention paid to licensure issues, certification, training, and monitoring, and states that already have their RFAs out in the public domain can be a good resource for states who are still considering how they might approach those issues. And finally, states talk about the anticipation of federal guidance on many of these issues, especially how they will coordinate with federal enrollment assistance. So what I want to do, next slide, please. So what I wanted to do now is share just two state examples with you, keeping in mind that if you've seen one state, you've seen one state, and that These are not necessarily representative of all states, but just examples for those states who have, still have these decisions in front of them, it might be helpful. So starting first with Arkansas, which is a state that's expecting to be, that is in a state partnership with the federal government, Arkansas issued an RFQ for in-person assistance in early March. They anticipate contracting with 535 assisters, and that once the first open enrollment period finishes, that they would actually reduce that number quite a bit. Their scope includes assistance for consumers who are applying for Medicaid or for private insurance through the exchange. They're very explicit about that. And they expect that the IPA role is much like the federal navigator role, which is in very clearly explained in regulations. Their plan is that agents and brokers may participate, but they, if they do so, they may not be compensated by insurers. The Arkansas Department of Insurance intends to be responsible for the training. And the way that they plan on funding IPAs is to provide startup costs as well as performance-based incentives for assisters who reached 85% of their monthly goals. So moving on to the next slide, thank you. So New York has taken a somewhat different approach. New York is a state-run exchange state. It issued its RFA back in February. The budget for their work, keeping in mind New York's got quite a few uninsured, is just over $27 million a year for 5 years. New York has built upon a platform of existing resources in the state, including community-based organizations and health plans who serve as facilitated enrollers. Further, they've included in their planning the new eligibility system, which will be up and running to serve the whole population. In New York, navigators and IPAs will provide the same services, including application and renewal assistance for all consumers, Medicaid and the exchange. The brokers, also known as producers, cannot receive compensation from insurers, and the Department of Health has the role of training and certifying assisters. So these are just two examples I provide to help states think about the range of decisions in front of them. There are another 8 or 9 online so far, and states can take a look at those and see what other detailed information might be useful to them, as well as we know that there are more resources coming from Kaiser going forward.
Great. Thank you, and thanks again to our wonderful panel for sharing this rich information that I think we can really build on moving forward. We are going to turn to Q&A now. Again, I'll remind you, if you have questions, you can submit them through the Q&A function. People have been submitting them as we go, so we're getting those organized now. I also want to remind people that a recording of the webinar as well as the slides will be made available on our website in the next couple of days following the webinar, so folks can get that information there as well. I want to start out with a couple of clarification questions to Dr. Stippelman in Utah. There were some questions about the availability of the training modules that have been developed. Are they available to wider audiences, and would they be applicable to wider audiences? And if so, how would folks go about getting those?
These would be available through the Association for Utah Community Health, the Primary Care Association. They're not. They will be in the future.
Right. And one other follow-up for you, Carol. The reminders that come from the database, are those going to the assisters and the clinic, or are they going directly to the clients being served?
The assisters. Those are the ones who have access to the cloud-based database. So that's when they check into that individual patient, that's who the reminder goes to. So then it's their job to contact the patient.
Right. So we know there's going to be a wide range of different avenues of assistance available under the ACA. Can folks talk a little bit more about what we know about the skills and characteristics that are really important for assisters to have, regardless of which of these avenues they fall into, and recognizing the diverse needs of the population, including people with limited English proficiency, and just a broad scope of different needs.
Is that
Carol, you can get started with that.
Oh, Okay, well, you know, besides the obvious, training them in the rules of the insurance that they're assisting with, data entry, medical charting for us, protected health information, HIPAA, all of those things. I really appreciated Donna Cohen Ross's comment about the privacy issue. These were tender situations, you know, where for instance, a mother would have to get a letter of non-support from a previous husband who was not paying child support. You really have to have the emotional intelligence to step gently into these very private areas of the patient's lives.
Okay. Jenny, do you have any other?
Well, I think another thing that's important to keep in mind when we think about assisters and the consumers they're serving is that in this new world, of course, there's the opportunity for a continuum of coverage where everyone fits somewhere, and some states may have holes in that continuum depending on how things shake out, but it's crucial that assisters understand the entire continuum that's in their state and can help connect individuals in a household who different individuals might be eligible for different programs, but it's essential that consumer can get connected to the programs for which everyone in the household is eligible through that one connection. So I think understanding of the broad range of programs is really important.
And Donna, as we think about that wide range of programs that's going to be available, as well as the new enrollment systems and rules that will go into place, can you share what sort of resources are going to be available to help not only individuals, but those who are going to be doing the assistance get acclimated to what that whole new environment is going to be?
That's a really important question, Samantha. I think at this point, I'm not able to talk about the full range of opportunities that will be made available. You know, I know there are some that are coming down the road, but what I will say about the program that I mentioned earlier, the Connecting Kids to Coverage Outreach and Enrollment Grants, as I mentioned, we are in the review process for our Cycle 3, and part of what we have been very cognizant of is that the period of performance is going to bump up against and overlap the open enrollment period for the, you know, larger coverage. And so we did solicit proposals that have to do with application assistance and also that have to do with training communities. As was mentioned a moment ago, we'll have a single streamlined application. It's going to be mainly an online application for a lot of people, even though, as we've already said, there will be people who need help. We've kind of turned the verification process on its head in a sense. Paperwork requirements of the past, the pay stubs and all of that are now not going to be the first thing that that we go to. We're going to be going to a data-driven and electronic verification system. So communities and people who have in the past been helpful to families are really going to need to get reoriented to a new way of doing things and a new way of explaining to families what they need to do. And so we've accounted for that in our Connecting Kids to Coverage application process because we intend to provide some of that training as part of this project. And again, there'll be other resources down the road, but this is one that I'm able to say a little bit about right now.
Okay. So we're getting a lot of questions coming in related to the role of insurance agents and brokers. As we look forward, can Jennifer or Tolbert, who's here from our director of our state health reform activities here at Kaiser, can you speak a little bit too about what we're seeing in terms of what we can expect from that role?
Sure. So I think most states are recognizing that agents and brokers are a trusted source of information for some individuals and particularly for small employers. And so I think states are grappling with how to involve agents and brokers in this process. Under the regulations, agents and brokers can participate as navigators, and most states are allowing them to also participate as in-person assisters. Though if they do so, they cannot be compensated by the insurance company. So in other words, if they choose to participate as a navigator, they must sever ties with the insurers. But states are also allowing them to continue to maintain those existing relationships with insurers and to continue to be paid commissions. However, I think many states recognize that there is additional training that these individuals need to go through, especially related to eligibility for Medicaid, as well as the subsidies available through the exchange and the qualified health plans that will be available through the exchanges. So I think, you know, again, states are in the midst of trying to figure out how to coordinate all of the various individuals and entities that are available to help individuals, and recognize that they need to leverage as many of these existing resources as they can.
Great. Okay. And can we talk maybe a little bit about, in this new world with the new streamlined enrollment systems, what steps of the process are folks most likely going to want or need help with? And are there steps that extend beyond initial enrollment that we should be thinking about?
This is Jenny, and I'm happy to get the ball rolling here. I mean, just going back to our research, obviously people want help figuring out that eligibility process, which bucket do I belong in? And I think when we dig deeper into that process, clearly the questions about income are going to be new and different for some folks, and even understanding how this new verification process that Donna described, it really turns things on its head, but it's new. So a process that's going to kick back information to you about you may be sort of new and bewildering. So to have somebody walk you through that and help you understand where that information is coming from and how to correct it if it doesn't accurately represent your situation is going to be really important. Anybody else have?
This is Jennifer Edwards. Let me just add that in some states, I think that it will be important to get out basic information about health reform and about new eligibility for coverage, because in some states there hasn't been a lot of good information yet to explain to people that coverage is available to them, that some of the information that's come out about health reform hasn't all been positive. And then I would also just add that we know from past experience in Medicaid and SHIP that a lot of children do churn, and so making sure that assistance continues to be available to families and eligibles through the renewal process, especially for those who have not had to go through that once before, they may not recognize the steps that they have to take.
And Carol, do you have any insights to share from Utah about how your sisters have tended to engage with families? For example, do they help with renewal, and also to what extent are they involved with helping families access care that they need?
Well, that was a very important part of our project, that we wanted to tie enrollment not only into just getting them covered, but also to teach them about utilization of primary care, because we had a largely immigrant refugee population. And the concept of preventive care was really foreign, as was the concept of insurance coverage. So it's not just enough to get them insured. You also want to tell them how to use it and what their rights and responsibilities are with health insurance. So that was a big part of the training and the software that we developed. And we had to just keep training and retraining in all of setting appropriate boundaries and helping the clients file truthful applications only.
Great. And now, let's thinking about the new eligibility and enrollment systems. Are there features? I think Donna, you started to touch on this a little bit, but are there features that are going to be particularly helpful to make assisters function better in their role helping people with it being available online?
Well, I think that's probably the beginning part of this, is that, you know, to a large extent, people will be enrolling online, but also anyone who's helping someone else will have will be helping people enroll online. And, of course, there'll be things that they need to know about how to do that and about that process. So you know, those features, I think, you know, the features that come along with the online application are really important, you know, help text and chat features to get information from the call center if you have a question, if you're stuck, that kind of thing is being, you know, contemplated as integral to making this a process that works for people and a consumer experience that is helpful. And the consumer experience, you know, being helpful also means that the assister experience needs to be helpful as well.
Great. And so I know we're getting a lot of questions about clarification regarding the different roles of assistants that are going to be available. Unfortunately, we can't really dig into the details of that right now, but I would like folks to just kind of step back, and if we can think about recognizing that there are these different avenues of new programs that will be available, as well as networks of existing resources, both within Medicaid and SHIP and for private insurance, what are really some of the key considerations we should be keeping in mind to just ensure that adequate assistance is available when enrollment gets started in 2013?
This is Jenny. I'm happy to jump in first again here. This has been really at the core of what Enroll America has been thinking about over the last couple years. And the bottom line is there can't be enough enough entities, enough individuals involved in providing this assistance and providing it well. And I think for all of the questions that folks have about whose role it is to do which functions, there really is a role for everybody. And we've been doing a lot of work with a number of different what we call enrollment stakeholders, different folks who, for whatever reason, are trusted messengers for some portion of the uninsured population. So whether it's hospitals or community health centers, as we've heard about today, or whether that's thinking about even health plans and what their role, appropriate role is in all of this. There's going to be formalized roles through navigator programs in some states, in-person assistance programs, and then sort of formal but not funded roles to provide application assistance in many states. All of that is important, but I think we need to think even more broadly than that about the partners that need to be brought together, not only to do the work, but to fund the work, whether that's additional philanthropic and corporate partners that need to be thinking about coming to the table, as well as just other entities that are going to be involved in this work one way or another, and many of whom who have whose bottom line looks better if they get more people covered. So we need to think about getting all of those folks into the fold and then really tackling the coordination challenges, which I think are next. So.
Great. Well, I really want to thank everyone, all our panelists for participating today. Again, we had Dr. Carol Stippelman from University of Utah, who really shared such a successful story about providing enrollment assistance in community health centers in Utah, and I think paints a real important picture of how you can not only provide that enrollment assistance, but move beyond getting someone covered to ensure that they receive the care they need and how to build on the trusted patient-provider relationship to support enrollment and coverage. We heard about the wealth of experience and lessons learned from Medicaid and CHIP that we can be looking to moving forward from Donna Cohen-Roth at CMS. Jenny Sullivan, thanks for sharing those fresh survey results that give us insight into what consumers will be thinking. And Jennifer Edwards from Health Management Associates for painting the picture of where states are in their planning efforts. And Jen Tolbert for sharing some of her work tracking where states are as well in their development of activities. This is a first look, I think, into where states are in planning for application assistance. There are obviously a lot more details that I know folks want to dig into and a lot more information that folks are hoping to hear in the near future. So we will be keeping an eye on that and making more resources and analysis available as more information becomes available and sharing that with all of you. As I mentioned, a recording of this webinar as well as the slides will be available later on our website at kff.org. And at the outset, I mentioned that this is the first in a series we will be moving forward with, focused on getting into gear for 2014. So we will plan definitely to be back in touch soon with new webinars as well as new resources focused on implementation as we head into 2014. thanks so much for joining us today, and we look forward very much to being in touch soon.